I'm a basic neuroscientist, and so my goal in life is to try to understand how the brain regulates behavior. And, you know, my belief system is, in fact, that the brain is the organ that controls our behavior. And that is fundamentally means that I have to understand the brain and how the brain works. Well, some years ago, we were fortunate enough to be involved in discovering the fact that inside your brains, there are, once you've matured into a full adult, we used to think that the brain was fixed and immutable, but it turns out that inside the brain, in certain areas of the brain, there are baby stem cells that continue to divide and give rise to new brain cells in just certain areas of the brain. So in fact, you are making new brain cells all the time, and hopefully tonight with a little bit of stimulation, you'll generate a few more, and they'll integrate. Well, that was a little bit of a surprise, I think, to neuroscientists as well when we revealed that or were able to discover that. In subsequent studies, we found that this process of making new brain cells, the fact that we make new brain cells in our brains, is not static. It's not something that sort of occurs at one time and just keeps happening, but rather it's affected by many things. It's affected by motion. Our movement in our environments can affect the rate at which these cells are born. But most strikingly, with regards to this, is that the environment, the physical environment within which an organism lives, can affect the survival and the rate of integration of these new cells. And through a series of experiments that we and other people have since done, demonstrating that complexity and various elements of the environment can dramatically affect brain structure, brain function, and consequently affect the behavior of those that live in these experimental environments. And most of this work was originally done in animal work, but now is being translated quite effectively into human work as well. So here I am thinking about this, and actually I was approached by architects some 10 years ago that came to me and said, oh, this is really interesting. How can what you're doing help us? And I was thinking, well, I don't really get it. But so I came to this, and I said, well, if the brain is the structure that controls behavior, and now I'm finding out that the environments that we live in can change the structure of our brain, then architects are changing our brain. So what are they doing? What do they know? Do they know what they're doing with regards to how they're changing our brain? So then the partnership began, which is, what can we learn about the built environment and how to modify the built environment and see how does it affect our brain? How can we build a discipline, a new discipline, that is an interface between those people studying how the brain functions and those people that are building environments that are affecting our brain? So you are responsible for a large degree with behaviors that people have by virtue of the environments that you build. Ouch. Okay, I'm not blaming everything on you, but it's on us, I should say. We're in this together. So then as I began working with with architects, I realized that maybe we could provide some of the measures of brain function might be useful to monitor in an experimental way how different parts of the environment affect the brain activity. So we had to develop tools that will monitor how the brain functions, and we have to use the existing tools but also improve them so that they're useful to the architect. They can take them into their environment and build them. But we have a ways to go. So one of the things that I also learned is that there's a bit of a gulf between scientists and architects, and this idea of In 2003, there was a meeting here in San Diego, which was the AI national meeting, called Beyond Intuition. And Gordon talked about this a lot, and I know that this is a very important and a part of architecture, is this idea of intuition. Well, in science, intuition is crucial to what's going on, but there's also something that's equally important. That's something called the scientific method. And the scientific method is something that we absolutely require of our work in order to build a body of knowledge so we can move forward. I'm just going to say what this is, because this is where I think the interface will have to be between this merger of architecture and science. And that is, you can have an intuition, you can have an idea that seems like a good idea. But then what you have to do is scan all the literature on that idea, everything that's known about that, and collect that information into a point where you propose a hypothesis. You don't just have an idea, you propose a very specific hypothesis. And a hypothesis is something that can be proven wrong. A hypothesis, you have to think about, how can I prove this to be wrong? It's not, you don't want to prove it correct, you want to try to prove it wrong. So you have to design an experiment around a way to prove, to test this hypothesis. So then you have to design it and design the experiment. And the amazing thing about the experiment is that it has to be a control group. You have to have something to compare with so that you can determine whether or not what you've done in your experiment has actually changed in the direction that you're interested in having it change. You do the experiment, you collect the data, you analyze the data, and then you do the whole thing again. You do the exact same thing again. It's called replication. Because if you can't do it again, you can't repeat it, then it was a one-off, it was an exception. And then what happens is we do what's called generalization. You make a slight modification in what's going on and see whether or not the general principle happens, even though you've changed it. And this could be the subject pool that you tested in changed. It was all male the first time, you do it all female and see whether or not that changes in the same way. So this is the general test. Now, how do we think about applying this strategy at this interface between architecture and neuroscience? Well, the thing we need are tools. We need some way to measure brain activity, not in the complicated way that we do that in the laboratory, but some way that we can bring it out into a architectural environment or a living environment, so we can begin to do experiments to see how different people respond. Now, what would be the elements of, at this point, I think there's a diversion, I think, or a split. There are going to be the neuroscientists that are developing the tools, and they're also developing fundamental knowledge about how the brain reacts to environment. So let me jump ahead and say that we develop, as there are, and Eduardo's involved in this, develop brain mapping devices that allow you to monitor how the brain is responding to different cues in the environment. And we want to first of all begin to understand, how do we respond? So you've got a helmet of some sort that's monitoring your device, or a simple device that's monitoring brain activity. And you come into, in Eduardo's case, a fixed environment, a very controlled environment, where you present stimuli, you present things in this room, and you determine and figure out how the brain responds to, for example, novelty. Is there, if you have a variety of objects in the or events or shapes in the room, how do different brain areas respond to these different objects in this room? You can say whether or not it's salient, whether or not, if you come back on the next day, do you continue to respond to certain events in a similar way? I'm giving examples. Or you take, if you identify areas, elements that activate certain areas of the brain that we know are important for attention and for even for qualitative values, you can take those objects and change the environment, but in a way that leaves these objects in certain spaces, so you can determine whether or not these elements of the environment have a persistent and consistent predictable effect on the brain. So now we have the beginnings of this, and I really believe that this is happening in now. And we were talking about this at lunch, and some of the new tools that are being able to be made. And I think it's incumbent on the scientists working with engineers to come up with simple devices that allow us to monitor them in easy ways. Because without that, and in these environments, we also have to provide information for what a brain activity means, whether or not it's a positive sensation, whether or not the person is behaving appropriately or qualitatively well. So let me give you an example of once we begin to get these tools, we begin to get some information about it, we can not only begin to see how individuals behave in a fixed environment or a changing environment, but in my goal is you can eventually see how environments can affect the plasticity, how we respond as individuals, how we change in response to individuals. So let's say we have a fixed environment with that we've learned how certain areas respond to certain objects in the environment, and we have a fairly large sample of people, and they have a consistent pattern of response to this fixed environment that is artificially induced, completely artificially induced, but it provides a baseline for activity. You get the baseline activity on the individuals, then you move them into your intuitive environment. You're building something new. You're building something that is based on principles that you've designed or maybe hypotheses that you have about how this environment might be better for the performance, be better for one thing or another. The individual then can moves into your new environment for some period of time. Think of this as government offices, for example, where they're moving from whole groups of individuals being moved from one workplace to another based on a new building being built. And you can monitor their performance in these probe environments prior to the move and then after the move. And what we'll begin to see is what aspects of our brain are changed by the environmental manipulations that are actually made that you're making. We'll begin to monitor the areas of the brain and how different environments can do it. You can pick two different environments and see whether or not one environment is influencing more than another. So imagine that there's a sort of an emergence of a new discipline where you have neuroscientists working in an experimental setting providing some basic fundamental information, which we're beginning to establish now, of how the brain responds to the different features of the environment. Meanwhile, architects are providing information to the neuroscientists, working with the neuroscientists to say, I need to know about these shapes or this size or these elements. I want to understand at an experimental level how an individual responds. Is it a positive response? Is it an effective response? The experimentalist tests this out in their environments, provides a device that they use in their experimental setting with data, how experimental individuals respond to it. That same device then can be used in a natural setting when people are living and working in their environment and compare back into the experimental setting so that we are actually collecting real data that then goes into a data set that will inform the next building that goes on. And this is not going to be a one-off experiment. It's not going to be a situation where we have the experiment and now we've learned all we need to know. This is the beginning of the formation of a science, which is the interface. This is neural architecture. You can call it what you want, but it will be the database on which young architects and young neuroscientists who are involved in this will begin to understand what are the questions, what are the issues that need to be resolved in the field of architecture, and the young architects will say, I need to have a device that can help monitor these kinds of effects. I want to know whether or not somebody performs better, if they're performing better, if they're perceiving an environment as being a positive environment, or whether or not it's a stressful environment. I need to have those kinds of monitors that I can provide feedback to. So this is, as I said, this is not going to be a single event. It's going to be a long, hard slog, and I think that it really is dependent on training a next generation of people who work at this interface. And right now, the older guys who are on either side of these disciplines can't do this right now. What we can do is we can talk to each other and try to plan for training that will lead to this next generation of individuals that are committed to obtaining and really discovering the empirical information, the factual information that will help them to develop their intuition into a into a measurable and effective way of designing the environment that optimizes the performance of the brain. So those are my comments. I think at this point I'd like to open it up a little bit to the audience for questions on Gordon's talk, things that I might have said that we could expand on, or if you have your own way of looking at this that you'd like to present. Here we go.
How long has this knowledge or study, point of view, whatever, how long has this been in the works? It sounds very new to me, and yet it's something I've believed in for a long time. And I'd like to have you tell us, is this a new thing to you all?
Yeah. So the question was, I'm telling you all these things as if this is common knowledge. And the question was, how long has this idea, this concept of a merger between these two disciplines been going on? And how much, you know, the other question was, how much data is there? Where is the website that we can go to and download the data so we can use this to design our next building? This is beyond nascent. This is still a collection of people on both sides of this that are trying to figure out the right words and language to communicate with each other. So we're committed to the fact that this has to happen, and we're out there getting some support from both architectural firms, in some cases, AIA supporting us in these initial probes to begin to find how to optimally do this. But this is very early. We all know it's a good idea, but the implementation is turning out to be a lot harder than we thought, because everybody's got their day job, and this is something new. But many of us have been involved in the beginnings of new fields in the past, and they often take a long time to get going. But what happens is that you say it enough, you talk to your colleagues enough, and you get a group of people together, and most importantly, you get young people involved in this that carry on this passion forward. And I think that's where we are. Yeah, it's new.
Yeah. It appears to me that the obvious studies would be on, you know, maybe sunshine and color. Could you give us an example of some of the things that you guys are entertaining to study that might be important to architects that we haven't thought of? I mean, you know, obviously we think about this lot in our waking hours day in, day out. But what are you guys thinking about?
Yeah, I would say that we've come up with this. We've had workshops, actually. That's another thing I should mention. We have workshops on... I don't remember. I mean, I don't forget, sorry. On things like color or things like wayfinding. How do you find your way through a building? Are there ways to design it that make it easier to get from one place to another, that make it either more intuitive or more active? And like light and sunshine and these kinds of elements with regard to brain activity or optimal brain activity, for the most part, these questions are not being asked in the way that it would be useful to you at all. I mean, we know a lot about how the brain responds. Sorry, I was trying to look for your... We know a lot about, or learning, we know a lot about how specific areas of the brain respond to temperature, to light, to transient light. We can talk about specific neurons. But that's not going to exactly do you a lot of good right now. What you would like, what you may want to know, this is where the dialogue really has to have. What about light and sunlight do you want to know that would help you? And then we have to design an experiment. We have to look in the literature and see that everything that's there that surrounds exactly what you want. Because I think It is a lot of its dialogue. What element about this do you actually want? And then we have to, if the information isn't there, we have to go get it and design experiments to get it.
I don't want to show any favoritism, so I have one question for Rusty, the scientist, and one for the architect. And I'll just start out with the one for Rusty, which you may have to defer to the architect. But in Japan, there are the major construction companies have architectural institutes, and they study building systems such mm-hmm. as seismic performance, how to grow things on roofs, acoustics, and they have these large institutes. I was wondering, is there anything like that in the United States that you're familiar with, in which they're just devoted to studying building systems and how they perform?
The building, from the building perspective, I'd definitely have to defer to my...
Well, Ken, I think that you know that there's a National Building Standards, National Institute of Standards, NIST, and but they're government-run organizations. I don't think, as I pointed out in one of my early slides, that there's adequate amount of research being done either privately, corporate, or architectural firms, et cetera. So there's not. There's not even, and what I tried to summarize is that the worst thing is that I don't think we even have a standard in terms of what would be defined as high quality, adequate research standards.
Scientific sector is through publication and through grant process, and there isn't really anything in the architectural field that does that except for sort of popular publications. But there's no scrutiny by peers to evaluate the quality of the research that's being done in the architectural profession.
We don't have a peer review process for all of our publications, as you know. Anybody can stand up and say that they're an expert in whatever they want to write about. And but beyond that, I think essentially for those who are interested in doing serious research, that there needs to be an agreed upon protocol, process, and a standard to which we would all buy into. In one of our early discussions with the scientists, they would say something, and we said, well, we can't do that. We don't have that. And they would say, of course. It doesn't have to be rigorous, because we all know what the standard is in science. And we wanted to know, how rigorous does it have to be? But they have standards, and everybody understands the standards.
Yeah. So there is, I was going to promote this. I'm going to come to you in a second. So there are members of our group that have begun to say, well, if we're going to have courses like you're suggesting, there has to be a textbook. There has to be something that you teach. And where's the body of knowledge? What is it that we actually are going to learn? So this is one of our, actually our founding president, John Eberhardt, was an architect who really got many of us interested at the interface of neuroscience and architecture, who wrote this book called Brain Landscape, where he makes the effort to answer some of your questions about what is known at the sensory level that might affect architecture, and vice versa. He spends a lot of time on methodology because there's not a lot of data, but I think this is a very informative book. But that's the point, is to teach a course, to have a course, we have to have data, we have to have methods, and we're still sort of developing that. Yeah.
Now, my question is, it's in regard to the fixed environments used to analyze brain reactions.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about using game design methods?
Well, I think that what we were talking about is that game designers, we do simulation as architects. Now, we use various software approaches to simulate spaces. But the interesting thing, I think, about the game design people is that it's much more interactive. And it's that interactivity that I think is very important. That coupled with, at the time of lunch, Rusty was talking about measuring eye movements. And that's certainly critical in gamers. My daughter is studying animation at CalArts, and I don't know how she does it, but you know, maybe all of you can do it. She can multitask looking at three things on the screen at the same time, moving her fingers in different directions. And I think it's generational, but I think that that's going to be a very interesting change in how we perceive space and how we interact with space and what's firing in our brain as a result of that.
But in addition, I would say that that format would be, from the experimental point of view, great, because then we'd have a controlled environment, and you could have different people going through the same environment, and you'd have an online data collection service that would go with it. It's not just the experience itself and doing it, but it's the fact that you could run enough people with enough diversity through it so that you could accumulate data so you could see what features of environments really are important. And having that person sitting in a setting while they're doing this allows you to monitor skin responses, brain responses, in a simpler way from an experimentalist than having to have these things attached and moving around an environment. So I think it's a terrific idea. It's probably only part of the way there, because you really want the physical movement in the environment. You want shape, you want size, features. But as one of the tools, I think it's probably great. And maybe the shorter distance from here to there. Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to offer an alternative manifesto for the rapprochement between architecture and neuroscience. You've approached it in terms of monitoring the brains of people while experiencing real and virtual architectural environments. But I'd like to see this society also explore the idea of what I might call neuromorphic architecture. What happens if the building has a brain? What sort of brain should a building have? There's a lot of development now in social cognitive neuroscience as we try to probe not just the brain mechanisms for interaction with the physical world, but interactions in the social world. So what if the brain is interacting with all the people in the environment? What does the brain have to know about those people, the brain of the building? What do the brains of us have to know about the building? I think this could be a very exciting complement to the sort of things you've been exploring. And then let me just finish with a sort of devil's advocate question. You talked briefly about eye movements and finger movements. What is the evidence so far that going to the expense of monitoring the actual brain rather than using behavioral measures will help us assess the impact of different architectural designs on the customers?
Yeah. So the first part, the brain of the building, just so I get it clear, your view would be to... Would there be plastic elements of the physical environment itself which would be able to monitor the ongoing activity? So that's built into the building rather than to the individual. I think that's brilliant. And it looked like some of those devices the curtains and things like that, were ideal for something like that could be used to monitor. So this is, you know, the things I'm talking about are not exclusive. These are examples, and I think that's a great one. And you know, and the other point certainly is. I would not like to make it a tension between behavioral sciences and the monitoring the physical principles. Behavioral science is essential. I mean, you want outcome measures. You want the physical movement. I think there's two things that we've talked about that. In order to have greater reliability of the behavioral response, in some ways. Having objective measures may reduce the variance slightly. So that's one issue, is that having, in addition to a behavioral monitoring, having a physical monitor of electrophysiologic activity, skin galvanic skin response, blood measure, some simple thing like that, that has an interval scale to it, may be complementary to a behavior which has an ordinal scale where you're rating these kinds of things. It doesn't have to be. I realize that all the way. The other feature is, just from an academic point of view, if we can begin to assign neural correlates to behavior in the context of an environment, then we're beginning, we may have the beginning of being able to understand how the brain itself relates to the behavior in this context of the environment, which gives us insights into behavior. So that's maybe too academic and not very applied, but I think from the neuroscientist's point of view, we would think that part of it would be...
So as Jack Kennedy said, ask not what you can do for others.
Absolutely. Well, no, and I admit that's how I came into it. I mean, you guys are building things that are affecting my brain. You know, let's try to figure out, you know, how that happens, you know.
Could you talk about the idea of heat sensors and a barcode on your wrist as you walk through a building?
This was a lunchtime conversation, so you have to be sort of, you know. But the idea, I think, that we're getting at is that in some cases we want to look at the average response. We want to build a building so that it's ideal for the behavior, the performance of the mean of the group. So you have a big sample and say, this building works for most people. And the larger number of people that this building works for, the better off it is. The alternative, or a complement to that, I don't want to contrast this at all, is to say, how could we build a building that has a brain, in some sense, so that it modifies itself in small ways relative to the individual? So this would obviously be helpful in hospitals and schoolyards, things like that. And the idea would be and this is not entirely fanciful, but the idea of individualized information about you as a person in some device that you wear within a building, so that lighting, temperature, things like that are all monitored on an individual basis ahead of time, and they're coded for you based on your environment. These are some of the...
Right.
Was this?
Yeah, and I don't think it's so far-fetched. There are a lot of office spaces, cubicles, that are currently able to adjust knowing who the individual is that's walking up to the specific cubicle. And so whether it's the adjustment of your chair to fit your ergonomics, the lighting quality, or the height of a desk for computers, all of that is available today. So I don't think that's very far-fetched, quite frankly.
Yeah, but it is a difference between building something or being able to take advantage of individual differences and expanding the utility of the built environment by taking advantage of technology as well as individual differences between people.
So I'd like to ask a little bit about closing the loop, as you mentioned, as the key thing for evidence-based design. And there are three terms that I think would be very helpful to have some insight into. The first term is success conditions. What are the success conditions for this room? The second one is co-adaptation, because the room doesn't stay the way it is, but we change it, we respond to it, we change it again. There is always a co-evolution and a co-adaptation. And the third one is interactivity brought about by digital interpenetration. So those three factors, the success conditions, the first step surely is to study what people actually do. We did a study of office workers. And so little is known about the furtive behavior of people in their own offices. What is known about what people do? What is known about people, what they do in this room? I have a flat tire. I was texting. So I was very busy trying to multitask. Was this room helping me? We had a lot of activity in this room, right? A lot of complicated activity. That would be an ethnographic inquiry that would certainly have to precede the equipping of instruments onto people and the measuring of neuro and physiological factors, because the success conditions are at such a bigger level, they're going to swamp the little micro things that are happening at millisecond levels. So I think the first thing to figure out is, what is it that, and that's closing the loop. You build the building. Now you go in and see just how have people been working in this building after a month, after 6 months, after 12 months, what are the changes? Now, a survey may not be the appropriate technique because the things you're interested in have to do with changes in workflow, but you have to have some notion of success. There's lots to say, but I think it's really a hugely promising area, all of the evidence-based stuff, and the neurosciences has got to have its crucial role. But the phenomena are so big and the measures are so confusing and so...
You'll go on to the other two as well, hopefully, and expand on those. But
well,
I would say that this is not the neural measurements are not an alternative. They're not supplementing. They would hopefully facilitate your ability to determine what works. How do you measure what works?
Performance.
Exactly.
Talk about stress. Change your boss. I mean, those things are going to swamp. Okay.
Well, I was just going to suggest that in my talk, I made the differentiation between building performance and human performance. And I think we have pretty clear criteria in terms of building performance, especially around issues such as sustainable design because of our LEED standards. We have also other kinds of standards, whether it's mechanical, electrical, airflow, et cetera, et cetera. And so we have building performance standards, but as we talked about, when you begin to infuse the human into that, our human standards become much more complex. And so the alternative might be this idea of a building being able to change in response over a period of time. And in a very small way, I often describe the California Academy of Sciences as a building which is similar to one's body in that it's always in transition. It's not simply a fixed container, but it responds to what's happening around it. So as the air is cooler or the sun is hotter, different pieces of the building begin to open and close in response to that. And it's like a human's body. If we're hot, we take our jackets off. Or if it's cold, we put another layer on. And that's beginning that's one approach, I think, is to have the building begin to respond accordingly in the kinds of ways that we're starting to see it at the Academy of Sciences and maybe even what Rusty was suggesting.
So I don't think I don't think they're these views are in conflict. I think they supplement each other, and I think it's very much the same discussion that we had earlier, is that it's not behavioral sciences versus neurosciences or environmental measures of performance versus neuroscience. That's what neuroscience is the same. It's a behavioral science as well. I mean, it's dependent on behavioral science. It's taking advantage of new knowledge that we have about how the brain actually affects behavior or controls behavior in some way. So we have a finer grain control or measurement of what's going on.
Go ahead.
Thank you. You know, I don't very often employ the word thrilled to describe how I feel. But tonight I'm very much excited by what you're talking about, your team. And the reason is that back in the early 60s, I got a group together at UCSD, including the chancellor whose subject was psychology, to talk about a proposed school of architecture there. And my idea was that we would talk about design, but we would talk as well about psychology, about the social and physical sciences. Now, I didn't know anything about what you're talking about, but I just had the sense that architects needed to understand human nature much better than they did, and all of the things that physically and emotionally affect their work and how they react to their clients. And I had a real going organization aiming toward a school like that,
There were many people at the school at UCSD who questioned, how would anybody make a living being that kind of an architect? But I said, there's a place for these people. I know there's a place for these people. If we could just have a school. And the trouble is, this chancellor left UCSD to be president of Columbia University. And my school sort of went out the window because I didn't have a real hero to lean on. But to hear you talking about this is thrilling me, I can just tell you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I happened to be at Columbia when we brought McGill to Columbia. And actually, there was the School of Architecture plan, but the last time we were in this state in the crisis in the early late 90s, the School of Architecture again went out the window. So,
Bill McGill was one of my heroes.
He was one of mine, too. I was at Columbia when he was our president. Anyway, I thank you all for coming. As you can see, we raise more questions than we answer. I hope it was sufficiently exciting, not just to my generation, but also to the younger people here, to think about the fact that in your careers, you're going to be using new knowledge, and it's important that you train in those areas, that you actually begin to think about how you're going to use this new information in your own practices as architects. So I think it was a good thing to start in an architecture school. We're going to move with this dog and pony show to the Salk Institute and then to Columbia. It's a Columbia. I spent many decades at Columbia, so anyway, to UCSD. And when you, if I hope some of you will come to UCSD for the third talk, we're actually going to have some demos of how we use a Starcave, an immersion 3D reality environment, to demonstrate in an interactive way how you can design architectural structures. And hopefully by then we'll have our brain scanning or brain monitoring and physiological monitoring available for you to try. Anyway, thank you again. Thank you for coming.